Blog Talk Radio.
And a great big hello and welcome. You're listening to the Palm Springs Savant & Company radio show. I'm Rick Rockhill, your host, and thank you for tuning in to Blog Talk Radio today. Well, I'm broadcasting from a beautiful day in the desert of Palm Springs, California, where we're well into the summer months and have 100-degree temperatures here when we hit our peak each day. So it's plenty hot, plenty dry, but abundant sunshine to enjoy this paradise. And one of the things I like to do when I'm indoors enjoying the air-conditioned temperatures is read. I enjoy reading. It's not only relaxing, but it's a great way to stay out of the sun for me and whittle away some time. So today on the show, we have a great guest. I'm really pleased to welcome an author to our show today, David Lummis. He has written his first novel, The Coffee Shop Chronicles of New Orleans, and David will be calling in very shortly, so we'll be speaking with him about his new book, which you need to go and pick up a copy online and check it out. But first, since we're talking about reading, I have to talk a little bit about the new iPad, because I went out and purchased my iPad and really am happy with it. And the reason why I mention this is I've been reading books on my iPad. Now, not all books, of course, are available from an iPad. It's you know, certain libraries and so forth that you're picking up. But it is pretty slick because you have this incredible technology. If you haven't seen an iPad, check it out. It's an unprecedented device, and it's incredible. It's about 8 by 10 in size. It's really kind of it's like a handheld computer that's really lightweight and easy, portable, carried around. It's a touchscreen tablet. It's no bigger than a magazine, really, if you think about it. And it can change how you do things, from accessing the internet, reading, listening to music, watching videos, etc. My advice, there's several ranges or several types of iPads. If you're interested in checking them out, they start small for $500 and they go all the way up to about $850, depending upon the amount of memory you want and the processing size. So I went with the granddaddy of them all, took the 64 gig Wi-Fi, and it's nice to have the wireless connection. You connect either through your home Wi-Fi or you can do it through AT&T service. But I'll tell you, it is pretty cool. I've been doing a bit of traveling lately, and to be able to just click on your iPad wherever you are, on a train, at an airport, wherever, just at a coffee shop, you can easily just take it out and read the news, check your email, or read a book. And so what I thought I'd just really get into here is how awesome it is, because I'm the kind of guy who tends to buy a lot of magazines. I always have a stack of books when I'm traveling, and an iPad kind of replaces that. Now, it's really about convenience is how I would categorize it. What happens is there's an application. Basically, on your iPad, there's all these little applications on here that you click on. So there's various things you can do. You can download applications. Many of them are free. Some of them you purchase. But you download these apps, and they allow you, or some actually come with the iPad, but they allow you to do things. So the book reader is pretty slick because you click on it, and it opens up this bookshelf-type visual, and you can go and download books. Some you can purchase. Again, some of them you can find for free. But regardless, I was able to read a couple books while I was on vacation and right here on my iPad. I didn't have to carry around a stack of heavy books. And it made things extremely convenient for me. You can increase the text, the font size. You can increase or brighter, more bright, less bright, all different things. The actual change the color of the page if you want to have a less brightness in terms of you can have sepia tones, that kind of thing. So the iPad is revolutionary in the way you can read a book. And if you are someone who enjoys reading and you like the convenience of just carrying a tablet with you for reading, I would highly recommend it, and it will make your life much easier when you're traveling especially. And the other thing that's really cool is, unlike a computer, these are so thin, very easy to get through security with the airport TSA group. So it's definitely something you're going to want to look into and consider it as an option for you. The other neat thing about the iPad is you can also utilize it for small amounts of work. So I have been using my iPad for email. I've been able to do things like, read small documents, PDFs. You can even read Excel spreadsheets on that, and that's quite convenient as well. There's a whole number of really neat things that happen to come standard with your iPad. So if you're the kind of person who, like me, you like to keep up on things at work even when you're out of the office, the iPad's kind of nifty in that you can do that pretty easily, in fact. And it's a device that is not going to replace a computer because, to be quite honest with you, there are things in that you can't do. So you shouldn't feel as though it's something that you won't ever have to have a computer again for, but you definitely will find that it will keep you up to speed with what's happening. In fact, there's other applications you can download. Again, some of them you might have to pay for as you expand your horizons with it. But it's not something that you'll find is impossible to utilize or understand. So check it out. Go to you can go to Best Buy. You can pick them up. You can certainly get them at an Apple store. They're all pretty easy to use. And you'll probably find that if you pick one up, you'll get the hang of it in no time, and it will change your life. So now the thing about reading a book, I want to get back to this, reading a book on your iPad. The thing about that is not all books are available on this systems, whether you use Kindle, that you can actually use your Kindle device, or you could actually download a Kindle application to your iPad. You can read books that are available through Kindle service, which is Amazon, or through your Google Reader. I'm not sure exactly how the iPad technology selects its book content. But not all books are available there. So sometimes you want to read a book, and you may want to do it the old-fashioned way. You may want to just have a nice book you can take with you and curl up in a corner or on the beach and not have to worry about getting sand on it. So if that's the case, then you want to get an old-fashioned book and leave your iPad at home. And here is my segue, delicate as that may be, into today's topic. I have found a great book that I've truly enjoyed reading, and I'm thrilled to be able to welcome the host to the show today. The title of the book is The Coffee Shop Chronicles of New Orleans, and I'd like to welcome my guest, David. Are you on the air with us?
I'm right here.
Great. Thanks for calling in. Really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Oh, thank you.
David, it's a pleasure to spend some time with you this morning, or for you this afternoon. I have really enjoyed reading this book, and for readers, for listeners today, I've met David a few times professionally in his other world capacity, but you, when you shared with me the information that you had written this book, it piqued my curiosity, so I had to check it out, and I've really enjoyed pouring through it. For folks who may not be familiar with you, I just want to give a little background on your bio. David is a nationally known consumer market analyst and author of The Value Retailing in the 1990s. Since 1986, David has written and edited dozens of syndicated market research reports, including on the U.S. coffee market. Raised in Paducah, Kentucky, David attended the Sorbonne in France and graduated from Yale with a degree in French. He now resides in the Paris of the South with his life partner. The Coffee Shop Chronicles of New Orleans is his first novel, and welcome, David.
Thank you.
So, before I turn this over to you, I want to read a teaser about this book, a little something I picked up, and it kind of caught my eye when I was reading it. Let me just get into it here. It goes something like this. Indeed, it may be said, I do believe, that Starbucks has done for overpriced tiny apartment dwellers and alcoholics in recovery everywhere what Martha Stewart has done for gay men and yearning housewives from coast to coast, creating an orderly, attractive, escapist haven that is both easily attainable and completely removed from from reality. Well, that's quite a passage there. I've got to ask you, this is your first novel, is that right?
Yes, it is, Rick.
Wow. How did all this come to you? I mean, when did you start working on it? What drove you to write this? And this is an interesting, it caught my attention when I read that, so I want to turn this over to you. Give us some background on how you got into this.
Well, this is basically a dream come true for me, to be quite honest. I've always loved writing, and you know, as you mentioned, in my professional life, I am a writer. I write business-to-business market research reports. But I had always wanted to write fiction, and I was never one to write short fiction. So I was determined that the first thing I ever turned out was going to be a novel. And that ended up taking 7 years of my life. And as the title of this may suggest, since this is just part one of the Chronicles, there are other parts. There are actually two other parts. So this turned out to be quite a long book, and that's part of the reason that we decided to publish it as a serial novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and at 320 or so pages in this part one, it's a good read, but it must have been quite intense. I can see how it took you this long to kind of pump this out.
Yeah, it was a lot of twists and turns along the way, and I know that there were several major things. So I think there are things in all of our lives that sort of push us to do things, mm-hmm. and unfortunately, a lot of times those things are tragedies, and I kind of noticed around the age of 40 that I wasn't getting any younger, and then there were a series of pretty horrible events. Beginning in 2001 with 9/11, that sort of shattered a lot of my perceptions of what life was supposed to be like here in the great United States of America, and sort of a little bit of an existential crisis going on there. And then it was sort of boom, boom, boom after that. The following year, in 2002, I had a very, very close friend die, very unexpectedly, and that was my first experience with loss and with grieving, and it was very, very intense. And then in 2003, I started sort of having this crisis in terms of my own career pursuits, you know, sort of really looking at my life and my career, and I felt like I was at a crossroads. And at one of those points where I really couldn't afford to stop doing what I was doing in terms of the market research, but also really honoring that there were other things that I wanted to do in my life. And of course, one of those things was to write. And a few years before that, somebody had given me a book called The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. If you haven't read it and you're an aspiring artist, run out and buy it. I really feel like I owe a huge debt of gratitude to Julia Cameron and to that book because, well, for many reasons, but one of the things the book recommends is that if you want to create, it gives you these exercises, and one of them is called morning pages, and it recommends that no matter what, you write 3 pages every morning. Even if you write the same word over and over, you do these morning pages. And so I started doing these morning pages, and I started doing them in coffee shops around New Orleans, and in one coffee shop in particular called Cece's, which is one of the local chains. And I was in there one day doing my page. Actually, I had been doing the pages at that time for a couple of years. And literally every morning, 3 pages. Imagine the pile of pages that you accumulate, things about yourself that you really never wanted to remember or know. It's a little scary. Mm-hmm. But what happened one day when I was sitting there is literally the first line of this, what has turned out to be a novel, sprang out onto the page. And I kind of saw it there, and I had fun finishing that journal entry, and it was just this very funny, light, observational musing about coffee shop culture. And I thought, you know, that was really fun. That felt good. Let me just do this. Let me just continue this. So I, you know, the next day or the day after that, whatever, I sort of wrote another one. And not long after that, the title for this book, Coffee Shop Chronicles of New Orleans, just literally sprang into my mind. And I just liked the sound of it, and I thought, that sounds like a book to me. Mm-hmm. And I originally sort of envisaged this whole project as being this series of like anecdotal, lighthearted musings, kind of strung together in my wildest fantasy, and this is really complimenting myself, I suppose, I really fantasize that I could do something like, you know, Tales of the City, New Orleans style, because one of my great heroes is Armistead Mope, and I try to read his Tales of the Cities book every few years. I put them away long enough to where I kind of like forget a little bit, and then I can go back and reread the whole thing again.
Right.
So I originally thought that this would be something like that, that it was just going to be, not that he doesn't handle weighty themes, because he most certainly does handle weighty themes there as well, but I really thought this would be light and fluffy, and it really surprised me, because it went in some very unexpected directions, as I know you know, Rick.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that, because you, from the very first chapter, you had me hooked with the title Mellifluously Mixed Metaphors, and it's a chuckle. This chapter is a fun read, and it's fast paced, and it moves, and it kind of sets a tone for the rest of the book, and it was a great way to start. But I was surprised and pleasantly surprised with some of the topics that you covered and you kind of dig into, it's clear that, for example, Hurricane Katrina influenced you in some fashion. I mean, how can you elaborate on that? How did you kind of, some of the serious topics you touch on, and that just being one of them, I think, as that influence kind of came to it, how did those things impact you to in your writing?
Well, you know, Katrina is actually, it impacted all of us who live here in New Orleans, and not just the creative types. It was obviously an earth-shattering event. And it was one of those sort of major life crises where you sort of ask yourself what really matters. And I had gotten serious about this book a couple years before, increasingly serious. So I was, you know, maybe 100 pages in when Katrina hit, and I had not factored Katrina in. Nobody really, you know, although it had been predicted that there would be a big one, you just never really believe it until it hits where you live, and then you believe it. And so we were very, very fortunate. We evacuated. We made the 14-hour last-minute mad dash to Dallas, and we were sitting in a friend's house surrounded by our animals, four cats and two dogs. We're big animal lovers, so we, of course, had to have them all with us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're exhausted. And we're watching CNN, and we go to sleep, and we think that we think, we dodged a bullet. You know, we heard that headline that everyone heard. Mm-hmm. And then we woke up and we turned on CNN and we heard that the city was filling up with water. And at a time like that, you're just kind of like, well, nothing that I really thought is necessarily true. It can all be taken away, especially all of these material things that we hold so dear. Mm-hmm. And we knew, and in that same instant, we also knew that we were incredibly fortunate because we were safe and we had a place to go. And from there, from Dallas, we went back to my hometown of Paducah, Kentucky, and moved in with my mother in her small condo with our four cats and two dogs. And she's not really big on pets, actually. So that was an interesting dynamic. Mm-hmm. But it was really a while, and we had 2 months of sort of exile from our beloved city. And we had 2 months where we really just didn't know what was going to happen, like everyone else. We didn't know if our house would be there when we got back. You know, we heard, okay, we didn't flood, but then you would hear the tales of the fires and the looting. So you literally did not know if anything, if your house or your possessions, whatever, would be there when you got back. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I was thinking, you know, I'm writing this book, and look what's going on. How selfish, you know, this little book in this big scheme of things. It just seemed so meaningless. Mm-hmm. And so we got back to New Orleans, and it was a mess, and I won't go into that. Everyone saw the pictures. But, you know, the National Guard trucks on the street, the Salvation Army food kitchen set up right around the block from us. And and I think that at that point it was really a time where I had to make a decision. I'm either going to continue with this book or not. And, of course, if I continue with it, I have to somehow factor in Katrina. And I didn't want to write a book about Katrina because that's not my story. That's not the story that I wanted to tell.
Right.
But you can't write about New Orleans anymore unless you factor in Katrina, unless it's historical. So I decided to set my book during the two-week period leading up to Katrina, mm-hmm. and view Katrina as a kind of a metaphor for the emotional storm that's coming as Sammy pursues this very emotional, personal journey of self-discovery of his own. And, you know, all of us who came back after Katrina had to find our own ways to cope. And my way to cope was to sit down and to write this book. And somewhere along the way, even though it may have already been that before, it really became my way of my love song to New Orleans and my way of hopefully, you know, in some small way immortalizing all of the things that I love about this city that's basically given me everything. It's given me my home. It's given me my partner. It's given me a big part of my livelihood. And so I guess that's, in a long nutshell, that's how Katrina influenced the book.
Well, I mean, it reads really well in that you almost have this anticipation, a sense of anticipation and build through the book as you proceed. And as one might expect from the title, the book is filled with these great references to the local New Orleans locales, restaurants, things, you know, the coffee shops, and just you get a visual, a very clear visual of the city. You know, if what's your routine like when you're living in where you live and what you do? Do you get out frequently? Are there neighborhoods you happen to spend most of your time in, or do you kind of are you a man about town?
I am not. I am not at all. I am a hermit, and I'm a very fortunate hermit in that I live in, as I said, in one of the areas that was less affected, in the Faubourg Marigny, which is near the French Quarter, all of which, by the way, is above sea level. And so these neighborhoods fared very well, and everything is within walking distance. All the restaurants or grocery stores, everything you need, you can go days without taking your car out very easily. And on top of that, I work at home, so I spend a lot of time at home. I spend a lot of time, you know, in front of the computer or basically, you know, gardening and stuff like that. But what is so wonderful, and this is what we try to do at least a few times a week, is to just walk out of our house into the Frenchman Street is in the Marigny. That's just a couple blocks from here, and there's a lot of great little coffee shops, Café Rose Nico, which I write about in the book. If you go on into the quarter, you've got Café Envie and CC's and Rue de la Course and just all of these great places for sort of hanging out. And if I had to sum it up, I would just say that it really is the Big Easy. And part of that is just because it's so darn hot here, especially in the summer.
And humid.
Whoa.
Yeah. And what's your fascination with coffee shops? Because that tie-in, I mean, it's interwoven so closely. I mean, it is. I think you touched on it earlier. There's so many things that happen in a coffee shop just to be an observer. But what drove that as a theme? Just because you happened to be there when you were doing some early writing, or is it something larger?
Well, it was partly that. I think there was something sentimental about that. That's where the book began, and that's how it started in terms of describing these venues, you know, which I really do think are sort of a fascinating cultural phenomenon that has sprung up in our lifetime. One of the good things, you know, like Martha Stewart, something that makes life a little bit better, you know, a little bit easier, a little bit more beautiful, something that says, you know, you deserve to treat yourself. You deserve something nice. You know, you deserve to have that gingerbread house for Christmas, if we're talking about Martha, or that third place where you can go and just splurge a little bit and have the cappuccino. And so I think that these are really very positive cultural influencers of our time that really do deserve to be documented fairly seriously. At the same time, what I would also add is that Sammy is a sober person, and I am a sober person, actually. I don't know if I'm supposed to say that on the air, but I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, 24 years of sobriety, and that whole culture, of course. Thank you very much. Yeah, it's the biggest accomplishment of my life. Without that, nothing else would be possible. So much of those early days of sobriety involved coffee. Whether it was, you know, the rancid coffee in those huge institutional canisters in the basements of the Manhattan brownstones, which was just wonderful, you know, and all the cigarette smoke, you know, it was incredible. And this was 25 years ago, mind you, and 24 years ago. But then, you know, during that period, the whole coffee house scene also sprang up. So it just became this incredibly warm and safe gathering place for all of these people who sort of just wanted to have a little peace, and they wanted to connect. And as a person who is pretty private, that was a very, very special time for me, and that it did allow me to sort of open up and connect with new people and places and things. And, of course, finally, New Orleans has an incredibly rich coffee culture. So you really can't live here at least not downtown, without literally smelling the roasting coffee from the coffee plants and of course, all the coffee houses that I already mentioned.
Yes, it's very, having spent a little bit of time in New Orleans, and I wouldn't say a lot, but enough to have sampled it, it's almost a romantic ambiance and sense, and those coffee houses and things really add to it. I mean, there's so much more than that, of course, but it is really a part of the culture. I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
There are some really colorful characters that you've introduced in this book, and particularly early on, this main character, B. Sammy Singleton, and other characters like Catfish, for example. What was the inspiration for those characters? Can you tell me a little bit about them and their journey through the book?
Well, it's living here in New Orleans. You really do see these people all the time. I'm not specifically. I don't want to get myself in any trouble here. So not specifically Sammy, and not specific. Any resemblances are purely intentional. Yeah. You're surrounded by these people. You know, in the South, and it may be a little bit of a cliche, but people really do sort of wear their eccentricity on their shoulder. So you know, you're just bombarded by it all the time. And I'm originally from Kentucky, which is, you know, I guess that's far enough south for me to be considered a Southerner. So I just, you know, eat it up, and I'm just watching all the time. And but as with many first novels, the main character, B. Sammy Singleton, is at least semi-autobiographical. I definitely will not tell you how far that line goes, but he's a composite character of which I'm as a private person, am a great part. And Sammy finds himself on this journey, as I mentioned, that is leading him into places where he never thought he would go. And in the beginning, it's because of his friend Catfish, who is heir to the Beaucur sugarcane fortune, reluctant heir. And the way the book starts out is that Catfish has gotten arrested on grave robbing charges. Sammy has literally gone and picked him up, and then within 24 hours of that, Catfish goes missing. So this is Sammy's quest to find Catfish, and at the same time, he ends up being led into sort of on this personal journey that he really didn't expect.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of unexpected twists and turns with the storyline and some of the characters who pop up. I mean, it was interesting the idea for grave robbing and you know, having read through it, I won't give all of it away here, but also having visited New Orleans, the sense of the history and the culture, and if you've ever visited some of these older parts, you see the history there. What was it that specifically got you thinking about grave robbing as a crime?
Well, the book actually includes lots of actual history of New Orleans, and part of that history goes back to 1998 when there was a huge grave robbing scandal here in New Orleans, and that's actually those actual events are woven into the first chapter of the book. And when all of that was going on, I just found it to be fascinating, and I thought, wow, this sounds like a wonderful Southern Gothic novel, and if we could just figure out a way to make it happen. And then, of course, I had the seeds of Catfish sort of inside of me as well. That this, what would it be like for a person whose entire existence, in a way, had been sort of derived from an income, a plantation income that had come from the roots that you mentioned before, the roots of slavery. And what would it be like for a person to sort of live with that knowledge? And so that's how the whole idea of Catfish sort of emerged in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't characterize it as salacious, but there's certainly some juicy things that kind of, you know, the origins of these. And it's really an interesting dynamic story that you've put together here. I mean, I really enjoyed it, I have to say.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate it.
It's been a great read. I think readers might be surprised to read some references to things like slavery in this book because you do have a few, you do touch on a number of more serious themes, and slavery is part of the history. It's a dark mark on our history, but it's there nonetheless. Would you care to expand on this topic and what inspired you to include that here?
Well, it's really what you said. It's a dark mark on our history, but you know, if we're going to talk about New Orleans or the South holistically, if we want to love New Orleans and the South holistically, we can't ignore that ugly part. That's part of it. Otherwise, you're just picking and choosing the part that you love. Just like with a lover, you might say, well, I really love the eyes, but oh my God, the nose, I can't stand it. or that hidden birthmark.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt really compelled to sort of include that part of New Orleans history in this book, because otherwise I didn't really feel like it would be an accurate or adequate representation of my own holistic love for this place. We walk down the streets here and we see the beautiful architecture and we hear the tour guides, or you go to the plantations, and we artfully avoid talking about that whole other side of it. But I think that by acknowledging that side of it, by looking at it, maybe if only for a minute, it just adds to the richness of our ability to really appreciate everything that we as Americans have been blessed with.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I've had the good fortune to travel all around the world and see all kinds of great things, cities that were built by slaves, pyramids built by slaves, any number of ethnic cultures. Slavery was part of how some great societies and great places kind of came about. And while it's not something to be proud of by any means, it is nonetheless part of the history. And I've been struck by that myself in marveling at certain things and saying, wow, I mean, this is an amazing sight that you admire at times, and then you have to stop and think that there were some incredible stories and history of people. I mean, real people's lives went into, you know, the blood, sweat, and tears in some cases, and worse, to build these things that today we walk past each day and don't give it a fleeting thought. So I think how you've done this here in your book is an interesting way. It resonated with me, because I have very similar thoughts when I look at things that are historical in New Orleans. Again, this is part of the South.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and also, again, as a sober person, you know, it's really all about trying to be honest. You know, you're never going to be there completely. At least I don't think I ever will be. But we try, and we go back, and we look at our past, and we excavate, and we own it. We have to own it all. If we want to be whole people, and if we really want to heal from whatever it is that we need to heal from, whether it's some kind of an addiction or whether it's a grieving or some other form of loss, I think it's just so important to look at all the parts and to sort of collect them and to treasure them and to cry over them. And, you know, in the South, we know that the best laughter always comes after you can't cry anymore. So that's kind of what the aim of this book was.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of how I felt was part of the theme, the journey of the characters here. It is about exactly what you just said, and that is what the theme that kind of resonated through the whole book for me was that journey. So again, it was very real, and you know, at some points I saw bits of myself in these characters, and for that reason too. For folks listening, we're talking with David Lummis, who's author of Coffee Shop Chronicles of New Orleans. It's a novel. This is part one of the novel, and it is out, available now. You can purchase it online at coffeeshopchronicles.com. And we're speaking with David. I'm happy to have you here.
Thank you.
So I would love it if you have, if there's a passage, I'm going to put you on the spot, if there's a passage or an excerpt or something from the book, a couple of minutes, if you wouldn't mind reading whatever you might grab handy. If there's something that you think kind of embodies or highlights some element of the book, would you be willing to do something like that?
Oh, absolutely.
Have a copy handy?
I would be honored. I have my copy handy, and this will be my very first public reading. So,
I'm honored then to have you here. Great.
Yep, thank you. We have a couple things lined up down here in New Orleans, but yep, this is it. This is the first one. I actually have a couple, so just depending on the time, this first one is pretty short. So if you need more, you want more, I'd be happy to read another one after this. But
yeah, go ahead.
This first little part is Sammy's first initiation the Café du Monde when he comes to town, and he's been introduced to this tour guide who he only knows in this brief moment, whose name is Christopher. And Sammy often narrates from the local coffee shops around town. And this chapter is also being narrated from Café du Monde. So here goes. Also, in all fairness, it's to Christopher that I owe at least a smidgen of my fondness for Le Café du Monde, since on that first day, almost 7 years ago, it was he who instructed me in the dying art of dignified beignet eating in breezy weather. And not just that, for his passion for those hot, sugar-topped delicacies was a privilege to behold, like an orthodox ritual, with him not hurrying the precious cargo to his mouth, but pausing beforehand to ingest its aroma, eyes closed, knees pressed together and skewed to one side, head cocked to the other, as if preparing to accept a wafer, ensuring life everlasting. A few months later, Christopher died from AIDS complications, although I didn't receive that news for more than a year, long after my zany impulse to call him up and ask him out had puffed by like powdered sugar in the wind.
When I read that, I do remember that chapter. And when I read that, it was interesting because I've been to Café du Monde myself several times, and you kind of set me up there for just the almost a visceral experience, and then you kind of brought in some serious some serious elements to it, and so it was unexpected, and I really enjoyed that aspect of what you've just read with us. It was great.
Thank you.
Really well done. Really
Thank
well
you.
Done. That's just a great. It's just one great example of the, as I keep saying, the unexpected nature of some of the things that pop up in this book. And it's really a treat, especially if you've spent any time in New Orleans. I have to recommend to listeners that you really will enjoy this book. Go ahead. Any others you want to share?
Well. Yeah, I guess there's one other. I just happen to like this little part. And this is from Chapter 9, and this is when Sammy – there are a lot of digressions in this book, and this is a particularly long flashback that goes for three chapters, and it starts in Chapter 9. And it's the first time Sammy meets his friend Catfish, and they will become very dear friends. And so this is how this one starts, November 1998. Times picayune in hand, I hesitate at the intersection of Charters and Domain, facing the entrance to a shop in a slim brick townhouse. Unevenly suspended overhead is a hand-painted sign with the script Creole Heart Antique and Objet, encircling a wobbly heart that could pass for the Valentine's Day expression of a lover too bereft to maintain a steady hand. Set back behind an iron column in a slice off the corner of the building, the shop's door is ajar, to tap into the idyllic late fall weather, I presume. Even so, as I peer inside, I'm not sure the place is open, since the jumble of rustic tables and chairs, many of them in an advanced state of distress, suggests repair as opposed to display. Backlighting the pile is a muffled puzzle of sunlight, which sparkles across a membrane of dust before repeating on the pockmarked red brick floor, where it combines the furniture silhouettes into the outline of a slumbering beast. Clinging to every inch of the opposite wall are shelves loaded with books and newspapers and colored bottles with raised inscriptions, some of them still partially full of earth. Although the shelves are flush with the inner wall, they seem to be bulging into the narrow path leading toward the dim rear of the store, where a library lamp ladles light onto a waist-high counter. Consuming the meager serving of illumination is a sheet of paper so heavy it might cascade to the floor, were it not for the cradle of fingers pressing it down. Dismembered from its owner by the sheer band of light, a hand sweeps a second sheet over the first with a rattle, snap, crack that startles me into opening my mouth. Are you open? Oh, yes. Hold on.
That again, the imagery there is very powerful. And when I having just, you know, it's funny, when I read it the first time, when I read that myself, actually, I kind of breezed past it. I remember pausing somewhere the page after where you finished. But now having listened to you read it, I mean, it is even more. I closed my eyes while you were reading because I really wanted to absorb it. And it's incredible how it just comes to life from your voice and certainly from the pages, too. So really great job there. I can't tell you enough how much I enjoyed reading this.
Thank you, Rick. That's a great compliment.
It's really good stuff. I actually selected one myself that was just kind of fun. If you don't mind, I want to share this with our listeners. It came from Chapter 6, and it was just something fun about church guidelines. And I'm not going to go with the whole setup as to how you got to this point, because that in and of itself is a great a great lead-in. But so the headline here is Church Guidelines. And I thought, since I'd already seen the darn sign, which practically slapped you in the face as you entered, on the other hand, it also occurred to me that I'd stopped reading after the first few words, as in immediately following the "Welcome to our cathedral" part. Look, 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 the crooked finger seemed to screech as it sawed back and forth across the bulleted points under the greeting. Would you please just leave me alone? I telepathically implored. The answer was no. Seeing no other remedy, I stepped forward and squinted at the sign. Please do not stand in back of the church when services are in session. The man nodded and lowered his hand, and for a moment we hovered in ocular standoff, organized religion versus B. Sammy Singleton. And ordinarily, that would have been it, and I would have been gone. But there was nothing ordinary about this day, now almost 7 years past, because there I was, in that city that had already offered to take me in, no questions asked, preparing to embark on something new, to set a course toward I had no idea where, and yet somehow trusted to be better than where I'd been. And so, instead of forsaking the house of, that house of God, I tucked my Times-Picayune under my arm and pulled out a 10-spot and tossed it into the old geezer's basket, then took my place in the congregation. So it's fun, you kind of succumbed there. I related to that, too, having moved to new cities and kind of gotten settled in, and you have those things you're confronted with, and you have to sort of just make some decisions very early on, very quickly. Do you run out of the building, or do you join them? Was there any reference or any truth to that, those guidelines you saw? That's something you really saw somewhere?
Yes, very similar guidelines at the back of St. Louis Cathedral. They may have been changed since I wrote that, but that's another one of the experiences that really is pretty closely autobiographical. It's of course very, very significant for B. Sammy Singleton, because he is an agnostic and he is embarking on this spiritual journey. Well, I just called it spiritual, didn't I? I'm not sure I had specifically thought of it as that before, but he's embarking on this journey of self-discovery, and for Sammy to actually sit down, to choose to sit down in that church and stay, to overcome all of those old demons that come from his youth as the son of a Baptist preacher, and to say, you know, city, I'm here, thank you, please, do with me as you will. That's quite something for Sammy's. It's definitely a kind of surrendering.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's somewhat cathartic, and I think for anyone listening who has experienced moving to a place, going to a new city, restarting your life, whatever, you know, anything like that, that it is a journey, and it can be spiritual, depending on how insightful you may be toward yourself or to things around you. It can be spiritual in that it is a rebirth, an awakening, and it is it kind of gives one pause to sort of think of things in a different light. I experienced that multiple times in my life. I'm fortunate in that I've moved, I don't know how many times, from the East Coast and gradually made my way where I am today in Palm Springs. But for me, each time, and perhaps this is why some parts of the book really resonated for me, but when I reached a new city, almost always I knew no one there. There were changes in my life, whether it was work or personal, or whatever it may be, and I had this sort of process I had to go through, and these experiences I had, some of them actually aligned to what you've written with your characters here, and so I related. And I think anyone who's gone through those kind of changes or rebirths in one's life, this book will resonate as well. So the characters are fun, easy to follow. It's nothing too heavy, which is what makes it a great novel in my mind, but it also has some ring of truth, at least for me anyway. That was my experience.
Thank you.
So one of the things that struck me again, and you said this earlier at the start of our conversation, is this is part one, and at some 300-odd pages, I really enjoyed the book, and I thought, wow, there's parts two and three, and I think you even in the book you do indicate timing of those. So it sounds like you've got a couple, the other two editions in the works. What's the story with that?
Yeah, they're actually written, quote, written. I've learned to not say anything is done until it is done. This whole editing process has been pretty amazing and strenuous, but they are written, and we fully intend to release part two in the fall and then part three in the winter. Obviously, they continue sort of this journey of Sammy's journey. I don't want to give too much away, but basically in part two, he does continue his search for catfish, and I won't tell how that ends up exactly, but I think that there will be additional surprises. And then in part three, that part of the novel actually is set in my hometown of Paducah, Kentucky, where because by that time the hurricane actually has caught up with them, so they've been uprooted from their home. When I say they, I mean Sammy and his housemates, and they are all living with Sammy's mother in her small condo in Paducah, Kentucky. So, and from there, it really becomes even more personal with Sammy dealing with some long-buried family issues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So this is, there's more to come. Yeah, I mean, this could easily come to stage, this story is so rich and has so much depth to it, or even on the screen someday. You've got some great, great stuff here.
Thank you.
Have you had any thoughts on what you would work on next? I mean, this is assuming you get all these out of the way and no further changes to them. You may have some other things lurking in your mind to begin writing. Have you started that thought about what you might do next?
Well, actually, I have to some degree. My partner Chabalu Koch writes screenplays, and we have several. Well, actually, we have a few, not several, but we have a couple that are really near to the point where we would like to share them. So once this very long book project is over, or at least the books are published, all three parts, around the end of this year, next in line for me is to get back with him, without whom I might say there would be no book here. If it hadn't been for his saying, do it, take the time you need, I'll take care of everything, then there would be no book. This is as much his book as it is mine, no question about it. Not to mention all of the times where I just didn't know what the heck I was doing, and he said, look, let's just sit down and talk about it. And he would sort of talk me out of my frenzy or my hysteria, whatever it was at the time.
A sharp smack in the face with a strong cup of coffee, I wonder?
Absolutely, yeah, the coffee definitely. That's the other thing, when people say, how did the book start, I usually say, well, I just had too much coffee, you know.
So this book was published by Riverhouse Publishing, local independent publishing house. Where can people buy it, make copies? Is it just from your website today? Is that right?
Well, actually, if you're outside of New Orleans, that's definitely the best place to go right now, and that's coffeeshopchronicles.com. Mm-hmm. We are available in most of the great independent bookshops around New Orleans, and some of the coffee houses as well. I know you started out your show talking about the e-books, but I just want to put in a plug for the indie bookshops. You know, we do not want those to disappear. Even us little authors who are going the whole e-book route, which is going to be next month, we'll be rolling out into all of the e-book formats. But in the meantime, please support the independent bookstores and even the chains, because these are just such an important part of our culture, and we certainly don't want them to disappear.
Agreed. And you know, it's interesting that you mention that, because I want to give a plug as well. I have long been a fan of bookshops, and as a kid, I mean, literally as a kid, I was in grammar school, and I would, after school, go down to where my dad worked, and there was a bookshop right next to his where his office was, and I didn't want to sit around and wait for my dad to be finished to go home, so I would just go next door into the bookshop, and as a kid, I was a little naughty. I would just kind of read a chapter a day for free, and then book back on the shelf. And eventually, I learned when I had some money to spend that it was a place, though, that I could go and buy books and enjoy them and actually talk to people. Mm-hmm. And as I got older and had, you know, some money to spend, I would go back to that same bookshop that they had welcomed me in as, you know, kind of learning about literature. And I had people to talk to, people who knew the local authors, and it was a very powerful experience for me as a kid who had a thirst for reading, an interest in reading. And to this day, I like to buy books where they have book signings, when the author comes in and reads. It's a great experience. And whether or not it's a well-known author or just a local author, it doesn't matter. It's someone's sharing something they created with you. And I encourage anyone listening to think about that, just as you said.
Absolutely. You know, just remember that feeling of opening a book and sticking your nose in it, you know, and smelling the paper and the ink. And ebooks will never be able to, well, maybe someday, but right now they're pretty far away from being able to replicate that experience, which is just, for me, just precious.
Well, I mean, I've been one who has embraced technology somewhat reluctantly. I wouldn't say kicking and screaming, but I have definitely embraced it. But despite so I have definitely an affinity for technology today. But in my home, and it's not a very large home, I have a room that I call my library, and it's filled with books, top to bottom, shelves that I have filled with books that I've bought, local bookshops, some when I've traveled to, but things that, for whatever reason, the pages have meaning to me, and mm-hmm. some of them just look nice and I've read, and some mm-hmm. of them are books that I have just really grown or helped me in my journey of life or just were mm-hmm. really fun. There's mm-hmm. a great read I had a number of years back. It was well-known author Paul Thoreau. Called Hotel Honolulu. I will never forget picking up that book on my way. I was heading to Hawaii, and I was looking for an easy read on the beach kind of thing. And Hotel Honolulu for me was a laugh-out-loud, fun read, and it opened up, it introduced me to Paul Thoreau, and it opened up a whole world of books and his writing style and travel writing and things. And to this day, I consider myself a major Thoreau fan, and my library is full. Every book he's written is in my library.
Wow.
Love the fact that I can go into that library of mine and just, I may sit there with a completely different book, and yours was one of them for some of it, and glance at the shelf and see Paul Thoreau's collection and say, wow, if it weren't for that one little original paperback, Hotel Honolulu, I would never have been introduced to these great writings, and I smile to myself, so I'm kind of reinforcing this notion of paper books or just having books physically in hand is different, and it can be very experiential. So I completely agree with you on the indie bookshop route. So, in
great.
Fact,
yeah.
Maybe there's a couple you want to plug. I mean, if you have some local bookstores who are carrying your book, any ones in particular, and if you don't feel comfortable, that's fine, but is there anyone you'd like
to call
out? Oh, I'm
totally happy to plug them. Actually, I thought maybe I should have mentioned them before, so thank you for that opportunity. There's Faubourg Marigny Art and Books, and the book is largely set in the Faubourg Marigny, so that was the first shop that we went into here in New Orleans. We're uptown at Maple Street Bookshop and Garden District Bookshop. We're in one of the local coffee houses here called Houdette Coffee Cafe, and we're also in the process of entering a few other places that I'm a little bit hesitant to say the names of yet, just because we're still talking with them. But I would say within the next month, we'll be available in many doors inside of New Orleans. And we're also available at a great shop in Florida, in Seaside, where I actually wrote part of the book. It's a bookshop called Sundog Books. And my book aside, if you're ever on the Florida Panhandle, be sure to go to Sundog, because it's just this wonderful little oasis in the middle of Florida where you can sit and have coffee and read books, and it's just a wonderful place.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, I just glanced at your website, coffeeshopchronicles.com, and there's a little icon there that says buy the book, and you click on it, and you can purchase it online, but if you scroll down, you do have all the some of the locations you just mentioned in Louisiana and in the, book, the shop in Florida as well. So if there are any listeners here who happen to be local to those areas, check it out. The details are here. The phone numbers for those bookshops are there, and it looks like you'll be keeping that updated. So I would really strongly encourage my listeners, if you're looking for something fun to read this summer, check it out, The Coffee Shop Chronicles of New Orleans, and you'll laugh. You may even cry a little bit. You'll have some fun, and it'll be interesting to look back on the history. And I realize that some of it is kind of fiction history, but it's based on actual history. Is that a fair statement?
Right, right.
Yeah.
There's quite a bit of you know, word for word actual history in there, and then there are certain parts that are sort of composite history. And there's an afterword in the book where I attempt to make that distinction.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think I do remember reading that. Yeah. So anyway, those are my recommendations. Check it out. It's easy to find here online or in those shops. And I have to ask you before you go today, how do you take your coffee?
I take my coffee very strong with two NutraSweets, and I like just a little bit of foam on top.
Ah, okay. And now, since we're on this topic, how much coffee do you drink a day?
Way too much, Rick. Way too much. Can't you tell?
Have you heard of decaf before? I do. I'm a coffee. Actually, you know, it's interesting. You talked about this moment in your life, turning 40 and such, and you and I are pretty much a similar age, but when I turned 40, it was a strange thing. I had never been drinking. I really never drank coffee in my entire life. I was a tea drinker for forever. And when I turned 40, it was like someone flipped a light switch. All of a sudden, I woke up one day and I said, I think I'm going to have a cup of coffee. It was the weirdest thing. And I just started drinking it. And I don't drink excessively, but I certainly have a few cups a day. And on weekends when I'm home, just relaxing, I'll make a whole pot, and it's very common for me to burn through the whole pot with a good book or something. So I don't know how or why that happened, but it certainly was some linkage for me in time in my life, and the coffee's been good to me, so
yeah.
I have
and
my
latest,
local shop.
And the latest scientific findings, all the antioxidants, and it, they're actually saying that it's good for you this month. So let's
right.
hope that continues.
Right. There's a great local coffee shop here in Palm Springs called Coffee, spelled with a K, K-O-F-F-I. And they only have a few shops, and they have, you know, aside from great coffee and all of the good treats and sweets and things, people who hang out in there, read books, read local magazines, newspapers. It's one of the things that it adds to the culture of Palm Springs and the village of Palm Springs, the old downtown area, which, even though we're a relatively new city compared to New Orleans, and Palm Springs really was populated in the 30s and 40s, so it's not that old. But the newness, the fact that we had to create something, a lot of these little coffee shops, independent bookstores, and fun little retail shops are what add to the culture of the daily life of what people do here. So I completely relate. Very different cities, but the love for reading and enjoying a cup of coffee and part of that whole culture that exists in coffee shops and coffee houses, it's the same on this side of the country as well as yours. Just a little drier, that's about all.
Well, we're definitely going one by one, state by state, with the indie bookstores and even the coffee houses. So, by all means, anyone in Palm Springs listening to this, if you know of a place that might be interested in carrying this book, we would really love to have it out there. I've been to Palm Springs, and I love Palm Springs. So,
great. Well, I really appreciate you calling in today, David. It's been a pleasure, and you're just taking the time to read through excerpts. The excerpts you read were really great. So I want to thank you for calling in today. Again, David Lummis, The Coffee Shop Chronicles of New Orleans. You can get to that from thecoffeeshopchronicles.com, and be sure to pick up your copy today. I'm Rick Rockhill, your host. You've been listening to the Palm Springs Savant & Company. Thanks so much for listening. And if you'd like to contact David, you can find his information on his website as well. There's an email, info@coffeeshopchronicles.com. Thanks again, David, and everyone
Thank you, Rick.
Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.